It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the national political conventions may be over, but there's a lot more to know about the links between convention delegates, states, and political polarization, plus how we could improve all of it. We've got that discussion ahead. First, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention changed its testing guidelines on Monday. It now says asymptomatic people who've been in contact with someone infected with COVID-19 don't necessarily need a test. That change drew backlash from some medical groups, including the American Medical Association, and it prompted the CDC's director to clarify the revision. It comes as the number of tests processed in Wisconsin and nationwide has fallen in the past week. A doctor joins us now to talk about when we should get tested, what's happening with COVID-19 treatments, and to answer your questions. You can call in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19? Are you wondering when it's smart to get tested? Maybe you're on the fence about going to social gatherings or need some clarification on how to stay safe. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jeff Podhoff is the Chief Quality and Safety Officer for UW Health. Dr. Podhoff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's start with those CDC guidelines. The CDC revised guidance to say people who've been exposed to someone with COVID-19 don't automatically need to get a test if they don't show symptoms. CDC Director Robert Redfield later said that everyone who needs a test can still get one, and the guidelines were meant to put an emphasis on testing symptomatic people. What do you make of this shift by CDC?
Yeah, when we saw this recommendation, it needs to be taken with a grain of salt. So from the technical perspective, if you had close contact with someone who was diagnosed with COVID-19, close contact meaning, 15 minutes, closer than 6 feet from them, you wouldn't have to get tested. But, the technicality of that is if you don't get tested, you need to isolate, quarantine at home for 14 days and not go out in public, have people bring you your food and things like that. That's largely impractical for most people. And if people trying to take that pathway would find themselves having to cheat to go get groceries or things like that, that would be somewhat problematic. Now, on the other hand, if you have a close contact and exposure to COVID-19 and you're able to get the test 3 to 5 days later, well, you're back in business, whether it be going to work, going to the grocery store, leading a normal life, in just a couple days. So although technically you don't have to get tested if you're able to quarantine for that long, most of us are going to find it pretty impractical to quarantine that long and probably better to get that test when you're a close contact to kind of know for sure whether you're a risk to other people or not.
And that's because we're learning more about the role that asymptomatic people play in spreading this new coronavirus. What does that look like?
Yeah, the more we learn, the more it looks like asymptomatic people can clearly spread the disease. Now, they may not be quite as efficient spreaders as those people who have fevers and pretty objective symptoms, cough and things like that. But those people who have those real objective symptoms, fever and cough, are likely concerned that they have the disease. They're probably staying home. The problem with asymptomatic carriage is really there's nothing to tip you off that you might have the disease. You're likely to be out there in public doing what you need to do, going to work. And that's really where these mask mandates come in, because you just can't know if you're asymptomatic and have the disease or not.
Well, the CDC director, as I mentioned, said everyone who needs a test can still get one. That's not necessarily true nationwide. I mean, I know people in other states who have had exposure and haven't been able to get a test for COVID-19. What does the situation look like in our state?
Yeah, there's regional variation as far as test availability. If you take someplace like Dane County or likely Milwaukee County, where there's a little bit more robust infrastructure for this kind of thing, it's not as hard to get a test. Here in Madison, if you don't have a primary care provider or can't get tested within a health system, we have the Alliant Energy Center open. People can get tested there. But as you look across the landscape in different communities, it may be difficult to still find someone who can order that test. May be difficult to find a place where you can go to get that test. Even though we would like to be able to test as many people as we could who've got symptoms, who may have been exposed, I think in different parts across the United States, it can still be logistically quite difficult for people to figure out how to get a test done.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff, who's the Chief Quality and Safety Officer for UW Health. And we're talking about the latest recommendations when it comes to COVID-19 and testing. And we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the current status of COVID-19 and testing? Do you have questions about symptoms of this coronavirus or how we're treating it? You can call now at 800-642-1234. Dr. Potthoff, what should someone consider when they are thinking about getting tested for COVID-19?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to consider is if you have symptoms. And symptoms can be a broad range of things. But, you know, what we're probably going to see are people are going to have a fever. They're going to notice that they have a fever. If there isn't a good reason for a fever, you don't have something else that explains why you're having a fever, it's not unreasonable to get a test for COVID-19 at that point. People with unexplained shortness of breath, that would be another, symptom that would make us curious as to whether or not you have COVID-19. So those people who have symptoms that they can't explain, you know, we're getting into fall allergy season. There's some people who are going to have allergies to ragweed, and that might be, you know, an itchy throat and runny nose. If it's your classic ragweed or fall allergy symptoms, you might not need a test. But if you're otherwise having, you know, symptoms of a cold, a good idea to get tested. Now, you know, the next group of people who would make sense to get tested is if public health contacted you and said, hey, you know what, like we've been doing some contact tracing, so-and-so who you know, who you were in contact with, was tested positive. They probably wouldn't give you the name, but they'd say, hey, you know what, we recommend that you get a test, you know, 2, 3, 4 days from now. Those people whom public health contacts and gives you the heads up that you might have been exposed, that's a good person to get tested. And then I think third would be people who know that they've had a close exposure to someone or someone who participated in an activity where they could have been easily exposed to someone, maybe in close contacts, unmasked, not socially distanced, i.e. if I had gone to the motorcycle rally in Sturgis and had been in some of these locations where we know there were some spreading events, I'd be concerned, and getting a test there is good. I think on the flip side, people who don't need a test are probably those who are just curious. Testing resources are still limited. So if you've had no exposure and you've had no symptoms and you're just curious, that might not be the best use of a limited resource.
And so the limited resources, and yet if you have had one of those levels of exposure, you shouldn't feel bad about getting a test, because this is about trying to stop the spread.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have symptoms or you were exposed, really getting tested is one of our most useful weapons in the battle against COVID-19, because people who are tested, who then test positive, if we can know that before you're able to go out in public and infect more people, that is one of the ways that we get on top of this, is understanding who has it, who needs to stay home, and who doesn't have it. And with COVID-19, that's tricky because of this asymptomatic carriage of it, where people could be passing it but not necessarily have symptoms. So if you're in a high-risk group, definitely get tested. Don't feel bad about that. We want you to get tested. That's how we get ahead of it.
And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Dr. Jeff Potthoff here. And we've got Donis, who is driving through Wisconsin. Hi, Donis.
Hello, this is Dennis.
Hi, Dennis. Thank you so much for that clarification. What are you thinking about with COVID-19?
Well, as us truck drivers have been driving from day one of the coronavirus, why hasn't there been a mass testing of all truck drivers to make sure that we're safe and we're not spreading the COVID-19?
Interesting. Dennis, thanks for that question. And Dr. Potthoff, what I hear there is that if Dennis hasn't been tested, Dennis probably doesn't have symptoms and doesn't have a confirmed exposure. So Dennis doesn't fit any of the categories we've talked about. And yet Dennis has done a lot of traveling and a lot of seeing different people.
Yeah, so individuals like Dennis are those who maybe do have high exposures or more contact with people. If they don't meet the testing criteria, it's still probably not a good use of that limited resource to do kind of broad-scale asymptomatic surveillance testing. But what is really important is that people like Dennis, who are coming in contact with a lot of individuals, really think about how they can stay masked and how they can stay distanced, because a certain percent of them might be that asymptomatic group, but because there's such a large group and because you can't really know where they would have got it from, it's unlikely that public health is going to be able to identify them in like a breakout, an outbreak, and tell them to get tested. So as long as they're not having symptoms and they stay masked and they stay distanced, we're going to be okay.
All right, Dennis, take those precautions then. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff, who is the Chief Quality and Safety Officer for UW Health. We're talking about what's happening with COVID-19 in Wisconsin and nationwide. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you curious about how COVID-19 is being treated or handled from a public health standpoint? Maybe you have questions about symptoms or about transmission or how we get this under control. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Taking your calls now as the conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff, who's Chief Quality and Safety Officer with UW Health, and we're discussing the latest developments with COVID-19. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Are you debating whether you need a test? Do you have questions about socializing or gatherings or how this virus spreads? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. And we've got Jean from Fort Atkinson on the line. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I am calling because I just wanted to mention that I have a friend who lives in Milwaukee County, and her husband had symptoms. So Dale went in and he got tested, and then it came back negative. So they said, well, can everybody in his household be tested? And they said, well, if you want to go and wait in line, you know, in the car, yes, you are welcome to be tested, but we don't follow up tests here at the clinic that they were at. So I just think that makes it a little harder for you to track people who live in the house, because a lot of people don't want to go and sit in the car for a couple hours in order to be tested if they feel fine.
Yeah, Jean, thanks for that experience. I know the testing does, the time of it, especially at those centers, varies greatly. I know we had to get my brother a test, and it took us maximum 10 minutes there. But Dr. Potthoff, I wonder what you hear in Jean's story about someone getting a negative test and then not really being able to accommodate testing the whole household at a clinic.
Right. So I think what you're finding, or what we're finding, is that, you know, health systems do have testing. Most health systems will have the ability to test, but their resources for testing are still somewhat limited. So it's not that they're necessarily running out, but they certainly don't have an overabundance of tests. So what you're finding is healthcare systems are typically testing those people who have symptoms, you know, the highest yield group to get tested, or potentially those people who had a close exposure. Public health potentially contacted them, said, hey, you should get a test. Health systems will test those people. For people who don't have any symptoms, and it's just kind of this surveillance, let's see if we potentially have it. The state testing sites and the county testing sites have been able to accommodate that to date, and that's why I think you're seeing this change in guidance from the clinics themselves, saying if you have symptoms, we can test you. But if you're asymptomatic or other people have tested negative and now your risk is very low, please utilize the county and state sites. Now, on the backside, when someone does test positive, that does get to public health. So even though it seems like that's a bit disjointed, behind the scenes, that usually gets connected once that test turns positive, if it does.
All right. Thanks for that answer, Dr. Potthoff. We've also got Bonnie in Lake Geneva who is ready to talk with us. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. My question has to do with whether my husband should have an antibody test. We were traveling home from Europe at the beginning of March, and right after that, he developed a strange set of symptoms. He had flushing intermittent with heaviness in his chest. And eventually the flushing went away, but the heaviness in the chest has lingered on. He's had a myriad of tests. Nothing shows any serious problems. He was finally diagnosed with post-viral bronchial, spasms or something. And he is getting a lot better, but it's been a frustrating experience. And I think he would just feel better to know, you know, if in fact that could have was COVID,
Yeah, Bonnie, let me jump in here quick because I want to make sure Dr. Potthoff has a chance to respond, because Dr. Potthoff, I know you can't give medical advice over the phone, but is an antibody test something that Bonnie and her spouse should look into?
Well, I think Bonnie kind of answered it there when she said he would feel better if he knew, and that would be the indication for an antibody test. You know, at this point, as a physician, if we knew that her husband was positive, there wouldn't necessarily be anything to do differently. We wouldn't change treatment, but there might be peace of mind that comes from knowing, was this COVID-19 or was it not? So that's something you can talk about with your healthcare provider. I know there's been some changes to the CARES Act where sometimes these antibody tests can be a little bit more difficult to get covered by insurance, but that would be the real reason to do it at this point, would really be for the peace of mind.
And the antibody test will tell us, in theory, if the body has already fought off that infection or is doing that.
Exactly. It looks for the antibodies that would say, yes, someone was exposed at a previous time, at least 14 days ago, but probably much longer ago, to the coronavirus.
Let's also talk about this FDA issuing an emergency use authorization for plasma. Dr. Jeff Potthoff is the chief quality and safety officer for UW Health. And this EUA, this emergency use authorization for plasma from people who've recovered from COVID-19 to be used as a treatment in current patients, the Health and Human Services Secretary called it a milestone. Some researchers have pushed back on this, though. What should we think about when it comes to this plasma trial?
Yeah, this one got kind of complicated because when the FDA kind of released the emergency use authorization, you know, some of the statistics that we were hearing sounded unbelievable, you know, 35% reductions in mortality. What we know so far about convalescent plasma is there's some small studies that would suggest that it's safe. But I have to emphasize that these are small studies. There's not a lot of patients that have been in them. So that gives us as healthcare professionals a little bit of pause. Would a larger study show some sort of adverse event that we just haven't seen yet? And then the studies that showed benefit, they weren't the gold standard. What we really like to see in medicine are randomized, placebo-controlled, blinded studies. And these were more comparative studies. You know, there's something called the absolute risk reduction and the relative risk reduction. And when you're trying to sell something, you use the relative risk reduction, which sounds better, but the absolute reduction is probably the better thing to look at. And that was showing a 3 to 4% benefit towards plasma, but in this comparison study. So things look good for convalescent plasma, but it certainly is not the golden key. It is not a miracle treatment by any means. And we do need to understand how it works a little bit better before we get really liberal with how we use it. Mm.
We are talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff about COVID-19 and all of the latest information about it as science gives us more information about this new coronavirus. And we've got Libby in Madison who wants to join the conversation. Hey, Libby.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
So I have a 6-week-old infant that we just welcomed. And of course, this is a time that a lot of family and friends want to share in our happiness and see her. And I'm just wondering about recommendations for that.
All right. Congratulations, Libby. And Dr. Potthoff, what about being around newborn babies?
Yeah, I was going to say congratulations, but as far as newborn babies go, so what we know within the pediatric population is that newborns, if they do get sick, tend to have hospitalization rates that are similar to adults. They tend to fare better, but they are a group of people that are a little bit higher risk. So as far as having visitors over, I would be a little bit hesitant to invite any kind of large number of people over to see the new infant. Now, there might be ways that you can be creative and still share in that experience without potentially putting anyone at risk. And whether that's virtual visits, whether you do that very socially distant, you know, if you had folks over to the house on one side of your driveway and you guys are on the other side of the driveway, it's not the same as snuggling up to a new baby, but allows them to see it, allows you to kind of share that experience, but at the same time, not really take any risk with your new family member.
All right. Hope that helps then. Let's also bring in Larry from Crawford County. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm just calling about what seems to be all the confusion. It's just so hard to get your head around. even by the, I guess, by the county health people. In our particular case, my grandson, who's 22 years old, living with me, I'm 76 years old, he's home from college, whatever, you know, he was exposed twice within like a two-day period by people who then tested positive. Okay. So we found out about this like 4 or 5 days later. We called the county health people here, explained the situation to them. They still did not, they would not send him to be tested at our local hospital here. They said, well, you could go see your primary doctor, which he really doesn't actually have here in town. It was just really frustrating.
Larry, I'm sorry to hear that. Dr. Potthoff, what should Larry's grandson do now? Assume that he's been exposed or try to get some sort of test? Where do we go from here if that was Larry's experience?
Yeah, this is, you know, similar to what we were talking about earlier, where logistically it can be very difficult for some people in some parts of the state to get tested. So in this situation, it sounds like Larry's son was potentially exposed. So ideally, we'd like to get a test in 3 to 5 days. If we can't get a test, the correct answer would be to isolate for those 2 weeks. What you're finding is, you know, going to a hospital emergency department or a hospital for a test, when we're just doing the screening to see if someone might have it after an exposure, typically doesn't work that well because those hospitals are limited in supplies and they're looking to test mostly those symptomatic people. Sometimes you can get that done if you have a primary care provider, but if you don't, now you're typically relegated to looking for a county-sponsored testing facility, either in your county or another county, and that can be sometimes pretty difficult to iron out, especially if you're not sure what to do. So I think this is just a good example where even though we'd like to have testing available for everyone, sometimes it just doesn't work out that well for some people who find themselves in this situation.
All right, Dr. Potthoff, a lot to cover here. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you bet.
Dr. Jeff Potthoff is the Chief Quality and Safety Officer for UW Health. And we've talked about who should get tested for COVID-19 and some of the challenges with that and when people should get tested and also how the disease is spreading here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, the Republican and Democratic presidential nominees are set, and yet it still matters how each major political party selects its convention delegates. Find out why here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the State Senate technically convened in a special session on police reform today. We recap what took place, the Democratic plan, the alternative bills, Republican support, and what happens next. First, the Republican and Democratic National Conventions are both in the rearview mirror, but the way those candidates were chosen at their respective conventions and the way the parties organize and direct themselves affects our national political landscape. Our guest has looked into some of the rules and the politics behind how parties choose their convention delegates from each state, and he put together some of that research in a piece for The Conversation. We're talking about it right here. John Turris is a professor of political science at LaGrange College. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Keely. Happy to be here.
Start by reminding us who these delegates are that we're talking about.
Okay. I looked at both the Democratic and the Republican National Committee, and they would have a series of conventions. These are about picking the nominee for president, and the delegates, I guess, would also be picking the vice presidential nominee, or when selected, they would ratify the selection. Now, what happens is every state is, in theory, awarded a certain amount of delegates, and I thought, they would be based on population. So bigger states would have more delegates. That seems to be rational, right?
Sure, I'll go along with that. Not so,
and this
though.
Whole thing started. Yeah, believe it or not, this whole thing started over close to the time Georgia had its primary, my sister-in-law, who's a physics professor, asked me to explain it to her daughter, and my son joined over, and he's about the same age. And so I was telling them about that, and I showed them a map, and I showed the delegates, and they looked at it and said, wait a second, Georgia has more people than New Jersey, and yet New Jersey has more delegates on the Democratic side. So then I checked in Michigan, where my mom's from, and I'm like, wait a second, Michigan has smaller population than Georgia, and they have more delegates. And that night, as my wife drove home, I pulled out the laptop. Normally I drive, but I said, I got to check this out. And I looked at all the states, both political parties, and I saw some big disparities. And I thought, wait a second, I always thought it was one person, one vote. But when it comes to the parties, that's not the case.
So are there a finite number of delegates that are allotted and then each party handles it differently, or how does that work?
Well, believe it or not, I had evidently a lot of learning to do, since I assume like everybody else. And whenever I mentioned this to other people, they said, oh, yeah, I also assumed it was close to one person, one vote. And I tried to look up the rule books, and these rule books can be anywhere from 40 pages long to 165 pages long, which explains this intricate formula for why Wisconsin has a certain number of delegates and how many Minnesota gets and how many Missouri gets and so on.
And maybe this is a good point to clarify that the delegates we're talking about, these are not the same as Electoral College electors.
Correct. But they are pledged to vote for a certain candidate. So when you cast your votes in that controversial election in Wisconsin, you're voting for, let's say, Biden or Sanders or Klobuchar. And then delegates, in theory, are based on how many you win. And some states have very complicated formulas for who wins and who doesn't. You should see Iowa's. And then, in theory, those delegates go to the convention, which in theory was supposed to be in Milwaukee, of course, for Democrats, and Charlotte for Republicans, and then they would officially cast the votes for a nominee.
So as you're looking at this and learning along with us, what are the political links then between how states vote and how many delegates they're allotted by the party?
Correct. Instead of being about population, in a nutshell, it tends to be how loyal are you to your to the political party? So in other words, like New Jersey, among the Democratic Party, they elect more Democrats. They vote for the Democratic Party in stronger numbers than in Georgia. So therefore, even though New Jersey has a smaller population by a million or two, they will get more delegates than Georgia.
Why?
So it rewards party loyalty.
Mm-hmm. So then what about those states that, I don't know if we can still use this, but that we've classified as purple? They're not solidly red or solidly blue, but they're somewhere in the middle and can go either way. Does that mean places like maybe Wisconsin have less influence on a political party nationally?
You know, you bring up a good point, Kaylee. I think that this is something, a missed opportunity for both parties, because for the Democrats, the bluer the state in theory, and there's some exceptions like Wyoming, for example, because of their small population and the formula, they get overrepresented. But the bluer the state, like say Vermont, Rhode Island, Delaware, they'll have more of an influence than the purple states, and definitely the red states. So states like Texas and Oklahoma, Utah, wouldn't get much representation among the Democrats. And for Republicans, blue states and purple states have much less influence than red states.
But even among the red states, for Republican, you write that a place like Montana has more weight with the Republican National Party.
That's right. And so what will happen is the nominees who are picked, and it's not just the nominees. I think the delegates also vote on the platform, and they vote on the rules, such as this one. And so it becomes like a basketball game of make it, take it, when whoever made the basket last gets the ball back instead of giving it to the other side.
We're talking with John Torres, who's a professor of political science at LaGrange College. We're talking about how the way states choose delegates mean that some have more influence on national political parties than other states. And we're digging into that. We've also got a question from Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the show. And I just learned something very important in your guest's last statement that I had no idea that it's about loyalty. But what I wanted to bring up was the comparison between the Electoral College, the way we vote for the president, and this ridiculous delegate system, the way we vote for our nominees for each party. As you remember, in 2016, Bernie Sanders was thrown under the bus by the Democratic Party, and the delegates that were supposed to vote for him during the nomination process, you could see them crying in videotapes because this system is so ridiculous and unfair. It should be one person, one vote for the primaries and also for the election. And until that time, we are never going to be properly represented. You know, I'm not voting this year because of what happened in 2016. So
thanks for sharing that, Ray. And John, what do you hear in Ray being so frustrated by the system that Ray says not going to vote?
I think that that's one of the weaknesses of this is you mentioned the Electoral College, and I did some numbers on the Electoral College, and it's the state with the most representation, Wyoming, followed by Vermont. They have about a 4-to-1 ratio of delegates per capita from the most rewarded state to the least rewarded state. Now, in the delegate system, the disparity is much bigger. In the Democratic National Convention, the state with the most per capita was 14 times more and 13 times more, or excuse me, 3 times more in the Democratic primary and 18 times more in the Republican primary when you go from the representation. So the Electoral College, you're correct, is not fair. Some states get rewarded by it more. I was shocked at how much more the disparity is for the Republican and the Democratic parties and their delegate selection process.
John, is it possible either party would reform their delegate allotting system, or is this just what we've got?
Believe it or not, I kept thinking, and in fact, I had an editor tell me, he said, well, when did this start? And I kept going back every election to 2000. And sure enough, every time I found it, you found similar disparities. And I guess those 163-page rule books are the reason why people just assume it's a fair process. And much like Ray, they may be getting wise to it, saying, wait a second, you know, some states are being overrepresented, others are being underrepresented.
What might the incentives be for either the Republicans or the Democrats to make a change?
I think the party that loses, or even if a party wins and doesn't win by very much, or they feel like they have to do a little soul searching, they should take a look at this system where they can see that, like you said, purple states or reaching out to Democrats, let's say reaching out to Georgia, which is a red state, which might be shifting toward the center, and say, why didn't we win more there? And maybe give them some more representation. If you just do it based on population, you can reach some states like Georgia, or the other state that gets underrepresented is Texas.
John, what an interesting thing you've discovered and thought more about. Thank you for joining us with what you found.
Okay. I appreciate it very much. Thanks, Keely.
John Torres is a political science professor at LaGrange College. We talked with him today about some of his research into the politics of how political convention delegates are allotted to states and how those numbers impact the parties as a whole. Coming up, we'll get the latest on today's special legislative session on police reform and take a look at what's coming next. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up at 6 o'clock tonight, you can hear 1A+. That's a new program here on the Ideas Network. It highlights the best from 1A, a daily live talk show about important issues like policy, politics, technology, and what connects us all. So join us for 1A+, starting at 6 o'clock tonight. Now, the State Assembly and Senate gaveled in a special legislative session on police reform this afternoon. They gaveled in, but only a few lawmakers were there, and both chambers are officially in recess until Thursday. Even then, it's unlikely they'll return for votes anytime soon. Governor Evers called for the session after Kenosha police shot Jacob Blake. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, good to talk with you again.
Hey, Keely.
What actually happened in the state capitol today?
So what happened is right around noon in both chambers of the legislature, you had somebody in each chamber basically gaveling in, gaveling out. And so, you know, what does that mean? In previous special sessions, what we've seen when they gavel in, gavel out is that they officially open a special session called by Governor Evers and they gavel out and close it, you know, and essentially close the books on it. They didn't quite go that far this time. They gaveled it in, they officially opened it, and then they recessed it, as you mentioned in the introduction there. So it's still technically open, but is anybody meeting here? Do we expect them to meet here in the next few days? We do not.
So how did Democrats respond to today's gavel in, gavel out?
They had a press conference before the session started, gathered outside the Capitol, and a number of members of the Legislative Black Caucus spoke. I mean, they were pretty harsh on Republicans, essentially saying that, you know, we don't need like a study committee now to see that there's a problem in our community. We know there's a problem. These bills have been out there for a while now. We've had time to act on them. And so, you know, essentially the time for saying we need more time is over and that there should be an urgency and that legislature should do its job, in their words.
And what did Republicans have to say about their actions?
Well, I mean, most Republicans were not here today. In the Senate, the session was gaveled by the Senate chief clerk, who's just an employee of the Senate as a body. He's not a partisan official. So he, nobody was speaking for the senators when it came to, you know, Republican senators, that is. In the Assembly, you did have two lawmakers there. Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke was one of them. And Steinke essentially said when he was asked, you know, why not gather here today for, you know, people who think you should, why aren't you? And he said that's not the way that the process works, that now that these have been introduced, they'll be considered. They'll be among a number of issues considered by a task force that's been convened by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. And he hopes to have some kind of a legislative package out of that task force ready by early next year when the regular legislature is scheduled to convene.
Sean, let's take a moment to define the terms. What exactly is a special session?
Special session is just something, it's a power that a governor has to convene the legislature. He can't force them all to come back, but he can force them to come in and, you know, bang a gavel on the date and time that he sets in the special session. So, you know, if he had a more cooperative legislature, it could be a way for him to bring them back at a time when they're normally out of session, which is now. You know, the legislature would typically not be at the Capitol right now, but, you know, they could, in theory, heed a call for a special session. So, you know, it's a power that the governor has. The legislature can do it, too. They can come back in what's called an extraordinary session when their leaders, you know, decide to come back. That's what they did during the, you know, the lame duck session of a couple years ago when they came back to strip powers from the governor's office before Evers took office. So this is just the governor's way of trying to do the same thing.
And we're talking about this back and forth between a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature, which is what we have now. This kind of thing has happened before these leaders have, you know, been the ones making these decisions. It's happened before.
Yeah, I mean, I think a special session, even when it was Governor Walker, he would at times call a special session and they would kind of officially convene it and wouldn't necessarily act right away. But they would not be, I would say that I never saw Republican lawmakers ignore completely a special session called by Governor Walker. That is something that they have done with Governor Evers on other issues. I think, you know, the one that's most recent was the governor's attempt to delay the April 7th election. That was one where they did come in, gavel out, they're done. And that was all they had with that one.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief, and we're talking about today's special session, what that actually means and how we should think about it as people who live here in Wisconsin. Sean, you've mentioned that the governor wanted lawmakers to take up this package of bills that he introduced in June after the death of George Floyd, killed by a Minneapolis police officer. It wasn't just Evers and Democratic lawmakers saying Republicans should work on those bills. The Milwaukee Bucks got involved, too.
They did, yeah. I mean, we've never seen this before where a professional sports team, especially one on a playoff run, decides that in order to make a statement, they weren't going to play. I mean, they were prepared to forfeit a playoff game in order to call attention to, this special session. They did come back and play. They won that playoff series that they, sat out. And, they were heartened by their protests spreading to other teams and other leagues. You know, you saw a lot of teams decide that they were going to not play for a day or not practice for a day in order to bring attention to this issue. But, they were disappointed that it didn't lead to, the result that they wanted, which is votes on these bills.
So we know that Governor Evers has some proposals. We know that Republicans are considering other measures. Are Democrats and Republicans on the same page of any of the ideas that they've floated so far?
There may be potentially some overlap with Republican Senator Van Wongard on some of his proposals, but I would say they were pretty far apart on others. For example, one of Wongard's proposals would, for communities that reduce funding to police, which has been kind of a recurring call you've heard from Black Lives Matter protesters, his proposal would reduce state funding to those communities. So in essence, if they defund police, the state would defund them. That is far from what the governor is talking about doing. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who is running for Congress, also talked about wanting to see some kind of a legislation that would lead to enhanced penalties for people who commit violence against police. Again, it's not the type of bill that you're seeing introduced from Governor Evers. Evers' proposals include a ban. They would ban police use of chokeholds. They would ban police use of no-knock warrants, create a civil penalty for racial profiling, establish statewide use of force standards for all police agencies, require officers to complete training on use of force options and de-escalation techniques every year. We require the Department of Justice to collect demographic information on the use of force incidents and publish annual reports. So, I mean, that's the type of bill that Governor Evers is talking about. It's not necessarily the type of bill that Republicans are completely on board with.
How realistic is it for us to expect anything to happen before November's election?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to share this little anecdote with you. I have not been at the Capitol much this year. We've been working from home at most other people at Wisconsin Public Radio. And so this is the first time I had seen the Wisconsin Assembly Chambers in a few months. And they're covered with scaffolding right now, So this. They're not getting ready to come into a special session. It's basically scaffolding from floor to ceiling as they do work on the top of the assembly chamber. It's not to say that they couldn't meet somewhere else or meet over Zoom, as they showed they can capably do earlier this year when they talked about some coronavirus legislation. But I think that kind of sends a symbolic point on where they're at, and they're not giving any indication at all that they are going to come back this year to vote on the governor's bills.
Sean, we know there's a lot here. Thanks for being up on it and reporting on it, and we appreciate your time.
Thanks, Keely.
Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked with him about the special legislative session on police reform. Republicans who control the Wisconsin legislature bypassed Governor Tony Evers' call for a special session on police training and policies today. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we're talking about trauma that happens when children see violence, especially against their parents. We're learning how to support kids and how the pain affects them into adulthood if we don't help. That's tomorrow on Central Time. In a world of flashy computer-generated explosions and incredible imagined worlds on our screens, there's something about the grainy black-and-white video from the panda cam that just captivates our attention. A week and a half ago, a giant panda at the National Zoo gave birth to a tiny, hairless, helpless cub. The camera's been in her den since, and just a few days ago, she first time left her teeny baby behind to get a quick drink. We could see the itty-bitty creature. It's light all over, but with those signature dark rings forming around its eyes even before it can see. Listen, it's not the absolute cutest baby animal, okay, but it is something. It's so vulnerable and yet so strong when it pushes up on its little legs. And it's just, it represents so much hope for this endangered species. I'll let you draw your own analogies here. So pretty soon in those black and white video clips, Mama wanders back, scoops up her baby, and settles in. They've got a long road ahead, but they're in it together. Thanks for listening here on Central Time.